You're listening to audio from Liberty Church Coomera. For more information about our family of churches, visit us online at liberty.church.
We're in the book of Esther, and if you haven't read the whole book yet, my encouragement is please go and read the whole book. This isn't one of those stories where I'm going to try and hold out on you what happens. I want you to have a read. I want you to listen. I want you to kind of read ahead the whole book. So please read the book. And this book is super relevant to us in this particular time. Esther deals with questions around how do you live in a land that is not your own? How do you live as a cultural minority? How do you live as a cultural exile? What do you do? What kind of decisions do you make when the pressure is on you from surrounding culture? But it's also relevant in this book because you'll notice that God's name is not mentioned. In fact, his absence is purposeful. Because there's times in our life when actually when we're looking at life, we're like, it doesn't seem like God is very present. In fact, knowing where he is at work is very hard to spot. And so the author intentionally has concealed the name of God, not so that we would be aware of his absence and implicate that he's not there, but rather that we would go looking for him. And that's the invitation, to go looking for this God who is at work. And we said last week, this book has a bit of a carnival theme to it. It has reversals, it has twists, there are masks, there are people who appear one way but then become another. There is crownings and uncrownings, there is comedy, there is laughter. And the whole laughter of the book is not just there to help us cope with life, but is actually there to give us hope in life. We are a people who know how the story turns out. Psalm 126 says, when the Lord restored the fortunes of Zion, we were like those who dream. Then our mouth was filled with laughter and our tongues with shouts of joy. I found myself in this position this week, in circumstances and situations beyond my control. The only thing stopping me from breaking down is literally laughing. Laughing because the Lord is still on the throne. Laughing because he's still got his hand on us. And through this, we can only cope, but we can hope. So today we'll move through three movements. If you like to have little places to hang the sections we are in, we're going to first look at a world that is compromised. Secondly, we're going to look at a compromised people. And thirdly, at an uncompromising God. So let's begin. Verse 1 of chapter 2. It starts with, after these things. Now, what are the things that are being covered here? Well, last week we were introduced to King Ahasuerus, or King Xerxes, that's his Greek name. He is the most powerful man overseeing the most powerful empire. He is so powerful that he has a party for 180 days. He brings all his buddies in, and they basically have a 180-day bender celebrating, reveling all his glory, all his goodness. Now, in this moment of drunkenness, what he does after his after party is he invites his wife in. His wife says, no, I'm not coming in, and he banishes her. She's gone, she's cut from the team, and as a result, an edict is sent out for all the men to be masters in their home. And we looked at how there's a little bit of insecurity, there's a little bit of overreaction. It's quite humorous. The people who think they're in power are actually quite powerless. But we finished the chapter going, gosh, not much has really happened. Let's be honest. Not much has really happened. King had a party, party's over, there's no queen, that's all that's happened. But in fact, a lot has happened because the throne is now vacant. The question is, who will now take the throne? It leaves this space, this vacuum open that we're going to look at today. So after these things, some time had passed, 4 years in fact. If you look at verse 16, that tells us the timeline. So it's been 4 years since this fateful day. And King Ahasuerus, verse 1 says, the anger of the king Ahasuerus had abated. He remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed against her. Now, imagine with me, and kids, you can imagine this too. He's made a rash decision in a moment of drunken anger. Has anyone ever made rash decisions in a moment of anger or potentially in the moment of other drunken situations? That's what the king did. And he finds himself here several years later. You can picture him almost in the courtyard where there used to be the feast and there was a celebration. All his friends were around and his beautiful wife. And he remembers what he'd done. And he just remembers, man, Vashti isn't here anymore. Now, this word remember is this kind of heavy-laden, almost nostalgic, regretful feeling. He remembered what he did to Vashti. He remembers that she's gone. Well, what does this king do when he has feelings? When he has feelings of anger, like in chapter 1, when he has feelings of loneliness in chapter 2, he does what he does. He gets his advisors. he says, I've got a feeling, not sure what to do. Advisors, would you help me process this feeling? This king is incapable of actually making decisions on his own. And what do his buddies do? Well, they think, well, let's cheer him up with the beauty contest. What the king needs here is actually another woman. Verse 2. Then the king's young men who attended him said, let beautiful young virgins be sought out for the king, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom to gather all beautiful young virgins to the harem and suits of the capital under custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch, who's in charge of the women. Let their cosmetics be given them, and let the young woman who pleased the king be the queen instead of Vashti. This pleased the king, and he did so. So what the lads reckon is not what the king needs isn't to search his soul, but he needs a body to hold. The goal is that if we just get something beautiful on the outside, it'll stop him dealing with the ugliness of the inside. Let's give him something physical pleasure to deal with his emotional pain. And so the search for Persian's next top model essentially begins. Now, the king isn't concerned with normal political things. Finding a bride that would give him political power or position. He's not after humor or character or intellect or long walks on the beach. These things wouldn't be in his eHarmony profile. He was after three things: young, virgin, and beautiful. So he gathers his women around the empire. Some scholars say up to 1,000 women were gathered. Now, these women did not have a choice in the matter. Verse 8 tells us that. Now, whether some of them went willingly or not is not exactly the point. See, for some of them, this actually was kind of like winning the lottery. They now have a chance to escape their life and have a crack at being the king's queen. For some, they were taken against their will. This was, as one commentator said, they were caught up in a carefully planned and orchestrated sexual abuse on a massive scale. It's not a pretty scene. We're living in a compromised world. But here's how the contest goes down. Verse 12 to 14 summarizes. Basically, each woman was brought in. They were pampered for 12 months. So in the Indota spa for 12 months, just getting it in spices. They were in milk and honey. This is why. This is treatment. This was get the women ready. And then they got one night with the king. Now, depending on how that night went, there were three kind of options that would happen. Option number one is they were then sent to the harem, which is a place for all the women to go after they have been with the king. Now, some of them were never called on ever again. Basically, they could not return home. They could not get a husband. They could not marry. This was it for the rest of their life. No legacy. They were now an 18-year-old widow, as it were. Some of them who were sent to the harem were called on again later. Essentially, they would now just live their life out in luxury, in the palace the rest of their days, but never allowed to leave a legacy. Option number two is some of them the king delighted in. He ended up marrying, becoming one of his many wives, and had children to them. Or the option number three is that they became queen. It was a brutal process. The stakes were high. And once we have again, we have this king, Ahasuerus, showing that when you have all the power, you do whatever you want. Can you see that this world is compromised? Story of chapter 2 here. Can you see the injustice? Do any of you hear this and feel a little bit enraged inside? A king would be able to do that? A person would be able to have such sexual exploitation? Do you get furious at the abuse of power and position? The powerful who take and the vulnerable who are forced to give? There's compromised morals everywhere. It's a bad start to chapter 2. It's not a pretty world to live in. I was thinking, we also live in a very compromised world as well, don't we? See, the difficulty would be if we read a text like this and we go, man, so glad we're not in that kind of a world today. But the truth is, our world isn't that far off, is it? We, in fact, have many of these things happening. Aren't beauty and physical appearance is still a major currency in the world today? Don't men want women, and don't women want women to spend exorbitant amount of time making their physical appearance more appealing? Aren't people tempted to consume the bodies of others rather than nurture their souls? Sure, people may not be able to get 1,000 women in bed, but they will consume a similar amount through pornography, taking the bodies, overlooking the souls, access to all whatever they want, however they want. In fact, you could probably say today it's easier to do what the king has done here. It is easier to abuse in one's minds with one's actions. Don't some people cash in the life of family and legacy for one night stands? The life of luxury? See, the way of the world is compromised. It's a dark world that they're living in. And I think it's this part of the story where we ask, if this world is so compromised, I wonder if it's compromising me in any way. After all, I live in this world. I wonder, am I compromised? And so here we end up with our second movement. We have a compromised people. We're introduced to two characters, Esther and Mordecai. Now, let's just feel the tension for a moment. When you live in a land that is not yours, you have to make difficult decisions about navigating that land. There's some categories that you can use. There's some stuff that you can receive from culture. There's good things you can take. There's some things you should reject from culture. There's some things you can redeem from culture. But essentially, if you really bring it down, there's two kind of, to walk the balance of engaging culture without falling off the slippery slope, it's very difficult. There's two slopes you got to avoid. The first one is simply to give into culture and assimilate. You basically receive everything culture gives you and you look exactly the same. The other slippery slope is to give up, which is basically to isolate. This is where you reject culture and you go live off in your own holy huddle. Think the extreme versions of the Amish community. So you've got these kind of, it's very difficult to navigate. How do we live in a culture that's not our own? Maybe you felt these tensions in your workplace. Maybe you felt these tensions in your weekends, how you spend your time. What can I receive? What should I reject? What needs to be redeemed? It's difficult. Well, let's see if our two characters here, Esther and Mordecai, have been able to walk this path well. We're first introduced to Mordecai, beginning here in verse 5. Now there was a Jew in Susa, the citadel, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, son of Shimei, son of Kish, a Benjamite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem among the captives carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away. Now, you... finding a Jew in the city of Susa is kind of like finding a vegan in a deli. You're kind of like, what are you doing here? This isn't your natural habitat. It's kind of like a fish out of water. What is a Jew doing so far from home? Why isn't he back? See, some 40 years earlier, King Cyrus had told the people, those who had been in exile, you may return home. The 7 years of exile is over. Decree has been issued. God's people can go home. This is what Isaiah the prophet was talking about. He's like, guys, guess what? Cyrus is letting you go home. So go back to Babylon. Go back, rebuild, become that spiritual community. Let Zion be restored to peace. And his prophecies, he says, those who remain, well, there shall be no rest for the wicked. So we have Mordecai here remaining. He's staying. He's meant to return home, but he's still living out there in the Persian Empire. Perhaps he liked the style of the empire too much. Perhaps it had this strong pull on him. I remember speaking with someone in Brisbane, and they said, Brisbane's just too small to contain me. I need to go to Melbourne. Like, Melbourne's got so much more room for me to live. It's like... you've got a high demand. And people in Australia, oh, Melbourne's not big enough. I want to go to New York. I want to go to London. Why? The pull of empire, the pull of prestige, of city, of Persia. Man, this thing had a strong pull on it. It can be very appealing. I mean, think about this for a moment. Mordecai is now not first generation exile. He's probably third or fourth. You heard the legacy, the heritage that he's in. So how much of the story has been passed on? How much of the values of the Jerusalem kind of culture has Mordecai embraced? Parents, when you think about your children, or grandparents, you think about your grandchildren, it really raises the question, what kind of legacy are you leaving behind? Are you raising them up in a kind of culture that will be able to withstand the culture they're living in? Is the Christian culture strong enough, not just to get them through high school or university, is it strong enough that their children may walk with the Lord? We see Mordecai here, he's a Jew far from home. He's a man who's already compromised. Don Carson once said, what one generation believes, the next assumes, and the next forgets. And this is the problem when you live in exile. The culture can just be so consuming around you. In fact, most of us are unaware of the stuff we've already absorbed and indulged in. That's the problem with Mordecai. His name is from a derivative of the god Marduk. So he's basically got a foreign god's name. He's in a position of prominence, most likely, here in the city. Now, he might have been carried away in exile, but Mordecai's just got carried away with the city. Then we have Esther. We have Esther. She has a Persian name, meaning star. Its translation, Ishtar, is after a Persian goddess. So she's named after the god of there as well. Her Hebrew name, Hadassah, in Hebrew it sounds like the word hidden. And so you're listening to the story like, ah, oh man, Esther, she's kind of Esther, but she's also hidden. Her real identity is hidden. She's a woman in conflict. Hidden maybe because the people of God are invisible in this time, maybe. Hidden because she conceals her true identity, maybe. Hidden because as we look at her concealing her identity, you and I go, well, we conceal our identities quite often too. All of us have masks that we put on. All of us have things that's not quite as it seems. So we have Esther. Here she is. Now, the only thing Esther, well, she could conceal her name. What things she can't do? She can't conceal how she looks. Did you pick this up here in verse 7. Midway through verse 7, let's read from the start. He was bringing up Hadassah, that is Esther, the daughter of his uncle, for she had neither father nor mother. Okay, so she's vulnerable. She's an orphan, so we feel sorry for her. It's the part in the story where everyone's like, oh, Esther, it's tough. This is hard. Your parents have died. You're in a difficult position. You're part of a marginalized. You don't have much going for you, Esther, but keep reading. The young woman had a beautiful figure and was lovely to look at, right? So she's got a couple things going for her. Don't overlook this. So she's, and notice that he says two things. Doesn't just say she's got a great face. Doesn't just say she has a great figure. Esther's the complete package. She's a lovely figure and she has a lovely face. People would notice Esther growing up. Her beauty would be known by all. People would see. Some girls would probably look at Esther and says, I wish I could be more like Esther. Why aren't I more like Esther? People ask Esther, how do you do it? Esther might respond, well, parents made it. I maintain it. I mean, this is really, how this looks is predominantly genetics. That's how it started. And it's at that point you actually realize that the way she looks is part of God's divine sovereignty. Just go slowly with me on this corner for a moment. Have you ever considered that the way you look is actually God and His sovereignty making you that way? Your smile, your nose, your height, your stature, all these things. God formed you and knitted you. He made you and created you. God knows exactly how you look. And He's delighted in you. Esther here is made by God. And in God's providence, Esther is beautiful. Now you say, that sounds nice for Esther. She sounds like a 10. I'm struggling to nudge up from a 5 to a 6. Now, but look here, where's the providence of God at work? Do you remember the very thing the king was after? The king was after a young, beautiful woman. Do you know who happens to be a young, beautiful woman? Esther. And so we see Esther is this young, beautiful woman. And so from these looks, her stairway to the throne now begins its ascent. She looks the part, and now it's time for Esther to play the part. You've got Vashti, the king's previous queen, who's defiant. I won't do what the king says. Then you've got Esther, who in fact is quite compliant. She takes instructions from Mordecai to conceal her identity. She takes instructions from the eunuch Haggai. She takes instructions from the king. In fact, she plays the part. She's more than happy to go along. It's the feminists love Vashti. The feminists don't like Esther here. They like Esther later on, but here she's compliant. She's letting this happen to her. Shouldn't she stand up? Well, what's going on with Esther? Well, is God perhaps working his sovereign plans behind this scandalous situation? Do you see that God could work in the midst of this terrible situation? She just happens to win favor with the chief eunuch. She just happens to get 7 young women serving her. She just happens to advance in the harem. She just happens then to please the king. Verse 16. And when Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign, the king loved Esther. Look at this. Esther more than all the other women. And she won grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. So that he set a royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king gave a feast for all his officials and servants. It was Esther's feast. He also granted a remission of tax to the province and gave gifts with royal generosity. All right, it's awesome. So the king here is like, I got a wife, you get tax cuts. That's how much we're celebrating. And my website won't crash to get your tax return. You're fine, right? So this is how it played down. This king is happy. He's delighted. He's cheered up. Finally, his problems are solved. He found a beautiful young woman. Now, what's going on here? How is God at work through this terrible story of sexual exploitation? How is God at work here through this compromising positions? I mean, if we stop for a moment, have you ever asked the question whether what Esther did was right? Have you asked yourself the question, is what Esther did right? What do you make of Esther's decisions to go be part of this? And some will say she was taken. Some will say maybe she wanted to go. After all, she didn't really have much affiliation with the Jewish customs anymore. Maybe she's one of those people that thought life had held kind of handed me a bad card. My parents are gone. I'm out alone. God will understand if I do this. It kind of starts to raise the questions, what would you do if you were in Esther's situation? Would you engage with this program? Would you die for your beliefs? Is Esther just trying to make the best out of a horrible situation? I mean, that's a valid thought. I mean, this is what she's been dealt. Is that just what she's doing? There's one commentator who said, if someone is willing to suffer the consequence, full obedience to God's law is always an option. Some of you go, no, Esther didn't have a choice, but did she not have a choice? You know, in the book of Daniel, you read about him and his friends in Babylon. And they drew some pretty clear lines. One of the lines they drew was that we're not going to eat the king's food. We're going to obey the dietary kind of Torah laws. Why didn't Esther do that? Did Esther observe the Sabbath when she was in the harem? Did she live out her Jewish beliefs and customs? Does the ends justify the means? After all, think about this. Esther's in a better place now, right? Finally, she's in a position of power where she'll be able to deliver her people. Sure, she got there through compromised means, but doesn't the ends justify the means? Have you ever experienced that in your Christian life, where the ends justifies the means? Maybe you go, this person I want to date, this is the only way they'll come to Christ. If I say no to them, then they'll reject Jesus as well. Okay, so you're going to missionary dating. That's your attack plan. Because God can't save any people otherwise unless they're dated. So often there's kind of ambiguity around our motives. This chapter raises questions around all sorts of ethics. Listen to a conversation the other day, and there was religious commentators who were talking about this ethical dilemma. You're probably aware of the one. It's the one where you're in Nazi Germany, you get a knock on the door. You're harboring Jews in the ceiling. They ask you, are any Jews here? Is it ethical to lie? What do you do? Now, what's interesting, one of the commentators said this. His response was, well, once society has got to a point when you're asking questions like that, the categories of right and wrong don't seem to make sense anymore. What you needed to do was ask those questions 5 or 10 years earlier. By failing to address the questions 5 or 10 years earlier, you've created an utterly perverse moral landscape. I think this is where we find Esther and Mordecai. They're in an utterly perverse moral landscape. The questions of right and wrong barely seem to make sense. Is it wrong that I would sleep and have sex with an uncircumcised pagan king? Can I marry someone who's a Gentile? Mordecai, should I leave this space to protect my daughter or stay in the city with my... The questions you're asking don't even seem to kind of make sense in the perverse moral landscape you're in. What if they'd asked these questions 5 or 10 years earlier? Have you wondered that? What if Mordecai had actually returned home? Esther wouldn't be in this position. And if Esther was in this position, you'd say, yeah, but then the Jews would be annihilated. Well, if you read ahead the story, what is the part, what is one of the things that causes the Jews to be annihilated? It is Mordecai's response to Haman that sets everything in trajectory. Question for us is, what if you and I started asking questions of ourselves that we wish we would have asked 5 to 10 years from now, earlier? I want you to stop for a moment. I want you to look at the trajectory of your life. 5 or 10 years from now, where are you? When you look back on your life in this moment, are there certain questions that maybe you can be asking right now that is going to spare some of the moral perverse landscape you might find yourself in 5 to 10 years' time? Will I be eventually found out for this? Is this the kind of parent I want to be? If I approach sexuality in this way, what will become of me? If this is my handling of finances, how will this fare? Do I want to be this kind of a person? Now, if you've been listening this morning, you've been thinking, Darren, you're asking a lot of questions. In fact, this whole story seems a bit complicated. Then you're in exactly the right place. This is a complicated story. See, if you want a nice, clean, clear-cut Christianity, unfortunately, the Bible's not going to give you that. In fact, it's going to come to you and ask questions of you. It's wanting you to ask questions of yourself and around these areas of ethics. Now, there's one place I think you and I right now feel this kind of confliction, and I think it's around this idea of how much of our Christian faith do we make known and how much do we conceal. If you've watched the media at all, there's a certain person named Israel Folau that is in this current situation. Yes, there is all the stuff around freedom of speech and rights, all that, but let's back it up. Back it up for a moment. How does one live out their faith faithfully? How do you make known that you're a Christian? Are you like Esther who conceals it? Verse 10, Mordecai told Esther to conceal her identity. Esther had not made it known to her people or kindred, for Mordecai had commanded her not to make it known. You ask, why did Mordecai do that? The text doesn't tell us. Presumably, he thought it might go wrong for her. What, it wasn't safe for her? Or that she wouldn't get the gig? She'd lose her chance of being queen. Again, you raise these questions. We don't know. The author doesn't tell us. But it's got us thinking, what happens if we do make our faith known? What happens if am I allowed to conceal? And if I conceal my identity as a Christian, am I compromising? There's a new job opportunity that lands in your lap. You move to a new office. You start meeting the people there. They ask you a little bit about yourself. You face the question, when do I tell them the Christian part? You're with a new bunch of friends. Maybe you've changed school. And the friends are asking what music you're into, what bands do you like, what films do you like? And you're just kind of waiting. They're probably going to ask me if I have any faith or religion. What will I say? Or you're at a wedding. And people keep pouring out the drinks. You're at a table with the groom's friends from high school. And they're pressuring you, please continue to keep drinking. And at some point you say, no thanks. But you know, when you say no thanks, they're going to ask you why. What do you say? How do you respond? Do you say, I'm mindful how much I drink because I'm a Christian? Or do you conceal your motive? You're at a party. Some people are talking about the receptionist at work in an objectifying way. Do you go along with it and keep silent? Or do you speak up? Let your faith be known. You find someone attractive that you maybe meet at uni or online. You find out that they're also into you. It's going well. You're getting to know each other. It's going really great. And you wonder, when should I tell them that I'm a Christian? Should I tell them I'm a Christian? Do you see? We have all these questions around how do we let our faith be known and how much do we conceal? Is concealing compromised? And just like Mordecai, we don't know how it will go for you. Will it end up in a rejection of a potential future spouse? Would it end up in a rejection of a job opportunity? We don't know. What we do know here is that at some point or another, we'll probably get it wrong. At some point or another, you and I will compromise. If not just on how we conceal our faith, we'll compromise in other areas. When you read Esther, don't be shocked that Esther isn't as good as you thought. She is not the heroine that she is later on. Here, her motives are mixed. She's not a savory character. So the question for us, for Esther, is, well, what will God do with a compromised person like her? And the question you and I have to ask is, what will God do with a compromised people like us? Yes, God is able to draw straight lines with crooked sticks. But how is he able to do that? How is he able to work through people like you and me who've already compromised in so many ways? How can we be drawn near to God? Well, I think about history, and I get so super encouraged about reading about the people in the Bible. Think about Abraham. Abraham, this was the one who was inherited the promise that his offspring would be as numerous as the stars in the sky. Yet he essentially pimps out his wife, not just once, but twice. We have Noah, who's faithful to God and saves his family from the destructive waters, only to find himself drunk as soon as he can once he hits land. We have David, man after God's own heart, but also a man after women. We have Moses, disobedient, questioning of God. And then we've got Peter, the Apostle Peter. Maybe you're like Peter. You know, Peter, the one who said, I would die for you, Jesus, only to be denying him three times within 24 hours. Could you imagine Peter's guilt and shame? Can you imagine how bad Peter would have felt that he's done it again, spoken out of turn, he's compromised? Maybe you're sitting here this morning and you realize that you've also compromised perhaps this week. Or maybe you look back on this year and you go, actually, I've compromised more than that. It might have been a big thing. Maybe it was small things. Maybe you've compromised in small ways that others wouldn't think are compromised, but you know they are. Teenagers or younger people, maybe you've already compromised. Your parents invited you to be obedient, and there's ways where you have been disobedient. You've actually kept things and concealed things from them. In fact, some of us right now, as we're thinking about compromise, we don't want to think too much. Because we're afraid if we think too much, we'll realize how much we have compromised and that'll tarnish our beautiful image that we've tell others and tell ourselves. We all have been compromised. We're all like Esther. But the problem is, how do compromised people come before a God who does not compromise? Because God doesn't compromise on sin. God is a holy God. He's a righteous God. He's a just God. He's a God who punishes the sinners. He is a God who does not compromise on sin. And so if we stand before him on our own terms, we will come under his righteous judgment. God cannot compromise. Then how do we draw near to him? How do a compromised people draw near to an uncompromising God? But this is where we need to understand the good news of the gospel. See, our temptation is to go through these religious hoops like Esther went through. Did you pick up how much Esther had to go through to get to be before the king? She had to be the best of the best looking, the best in bed, the best treatment, the best beauty. Sort out the externals, get it all sorted on the outside, and then present yourself for acceptance. That is the way of a compromised world. But the way of Christ is actually so much better. In fact, it is way more good news for us just to comprehend as we understand this. Our performance is compromised, friends, but Jesus' performance is not. See, Esther isn't the only exile in the story of the Bible. We have another exile, Jesus of Nazareth. He was the one who left his heavenly throne to come and live amongst humanity here on earth. And on this world, he did not compromise. In fact, Jesus concealed his identity. Well, did he? He let himself be known. In fact, he would head to the cross for not concealing his identity. He dies on a cross as the Messiah, as the King of the Jews. He's someone who walked in full obedience, even obedience up to death. And on the cross, Jesus experiences the exile from the Father, that moment when he's atoning for the sins of the world. So you and I can be brought near to an uncompromisable God because Jesus didn't compromise. He brings us before him. This is the Jesus that loves you and I. You know, Esther had to give up her freedom and give up her life to be with the king. What we have here, we have Jesus who gives up his life and his freedom to be with you. Tim Keller says, Esther was loved because she was already beautiful, but Jesus loves you in spite of your flaws in order to make you beautiful. This is the good news of the gospel in this text. Friends, we don't need to play by the rules of a compromised world where beauty and image is what will get us by. Looks will get you somewhere, but they also might take you into places where you compromise. I wonder if you believe that Jesus loves you in spite of your flaws. Do you believe this good news of the gospel, that God can draw straight lines with crooked sticks? I hope you haven't written off Esther just yet, because to write off Esther would be to write off all of us. God hasn't written off Esther just yet. In fact, he's using this very compromised situation to reveal his beautiful plan of redemption. If you're not a believer here today and you think you've blown it with God, you think we've gone too far, compromised too much, God wouldn't want to deal with me, I want you to know that there's hope for you. Not hope that you have to get it all together to present yourself before God, but rather you can put your faith in Jesus who's already got it all together and it can present you before God. And if you're a Christian here today and you're struggling to actually come to terms with accepting ways in which maybe you've compromised, or maybe you don't even know, would you come and through this lens of grace and let the mercy of Christ wash over you? The truth is all of us are worse than we realize. But God's grace is far better than we imagine. Let's pray.